Welcome to The Spiritual Voice, where Spirit speaks through everything and everyone. Together we learn from masters from all walks of life to explore spirituality through direct experience so you can create a life of clarity and abundance. I'm your host, Paul Cousineau, Transformational Leader, tuning in with you every Tuesday and Thursday. You can learn more about our global spiritual community and resources to help you cultivate presence and spiritual health by visiting thespiritualvoice.com. Global spiritual community and resources to help you cultivate presence and spiritual health by visiting thespiritualvoice.com. On today's episode of The Spiritual Voice, we have a theme that I find is particularly interesting. Dancing with words, dancing with wisdom. Now, why is this interesting? Well, for one, if you've been a longtime listener, or perhaps if you're just tuning in right now, you might know that I'm Francophone. So when I speak in English, sometimes, well, the words don't come exactly the same. A good example is the theme of the day, and then I really have to work on that TH, and then people are like, well, why are you talking about a theme? You know, T-E-A-T-I. Well, anyway, I was trying to spell out a team like a basketball team, and now I got caught up into the E and the I again, because in French it sounds differently. So that just adds to that twist. But really for me, it's been a practice, I would say maybe 18 months to 24 months, where I've been trying to listen very carefully to the words that I use as I speak them, as well as to the words that are spoken by other people, to really try to have a grasp and an understanding of what it is that we're both communicating. And I've been astounded at some of the discoveries about even myself by doing this practice. And I felt that this gives me cues into my own emotions, in my state of being, as well as, well, why is it exactly that I'm sharing this message, particularly in communication with family members or people that are a little bit closer to me? Sometimes I feel like I speak very quickly. And when I really start paying attention to the words I'm using, I'm like, wait, like, what I'm actually saying right now is not in line with the message. So sometimes it may be portrayed as frustration or intolerance. And in reality, what I want is I'm looking at finding a solution where we can plan perhaps an activity or a setup that will be enjoyable for both of us. I'm like, well, if I'm trying to reach a state of enjoyment and harmony, why am I actually speaking with words in a tone that has an underlying tone of frustration and perhaps even anger? This is strange. So, and then just bringing that to the awareness as well of, those family members or whoever I'm talking with. Well, that's interesting. It sounds like I'm frustrated here, but that's clearly not my intention. And that just allows to unpack really what's going on so that we can focus on that intention rather perhaps than the form that it was taking previously. So that's at least my take on it. Now, obviously, we have an expert on the topic that will be bringing a lot more depth to this. And I think I got the depth in there. So I'm just playing around here. So for you of those listening, you might be laughing, and that would be very fantastic. So our guest today is Dr. Janet Smith Warfield, and she serves wisdom seekers who want understanding and clarity so they can live peaceful, powerful, prosperous lives. Through her unique combination of holistic, creative, right brain transformational experiences and 22 years of rigorous left brain law practice, she has learned how to sculpt words in atypical ways, shifting her listeners into experiences beyond words, transforming turmoil into inner peace. See, even here how I went to the left brain law practice, and I put in that intonation. So I'm working really hard to try and convey more depth to the words. Janet is a retired attorney, author, publisher, workshop presenter, and consultant. Her book, Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World, an Amazon bestseller, won the 2008 Indie Next Generation Book Award for Best New Age Nonfiction, has been translated into 4 languages, and is being distributed throughout the world. Her website, wordsculptures.com, won the 2008 Coalition of Visionary Resources Best Website Award. In 2015, Continental In 2015, Continental Who's Who recognized her as their most prominent professional in the field of consciousness education. She is currently a member of the Shift Network Leadership Academy. It is a real delight to have you with us. Welcome to the Spiritual Voice, Janet.
Well, thank you so much, Paul. I'm chuckling as I'm just listening to you with this introduction, because you are very conscious about your words. You know, more power to you. You've already introduced the topic extremely well.
Thank you for that. And I'm happy that you're chuckling, because one of the things that I like to do is keep things very lighthearted, as well as really recognizing, I'm like, oh, wait, I've just been struggling in this area. I've been putting these intonations and what's going on, and the pronunciation was sometimes a little bit off. And I find just by pointing these things out, it just makes it... it does make it more funny, but also acceptable. And that's one way that I discovered for me not to be so hard on myself. Like, no one's expecting me to say like the TH perfectly in those aspects. So I'd like to start our conversation by having you share a little bit about how words came to be something of such importance for you in your life and in your work.
I've always been involved with words in one way or another. I was a junior high school newspaper editor. I was a senior high school yearbook co-editor. And I've spent a lot of my life journaling just to figure out what the heck was going on in my life and seeing if I could get some clarity from it. But then when I was in my early 30s, I had one of those life-transforming experiences that I wasn't looking for. At the time, I didn't even know what had happened or how to describe it or what words to apply to it. But the story, briefly, there are actually three stories here. The first one was my oldest son, who was age 5 at the time, began wetting the bed when his youngest brother was born. I had 3 preschoolers at that time, and I was really frustrated over this. I had plenty of stuff to do, and I didn't need to be changing wet sheets every morning. First, I ignored the behavior, and the bed was still wet. I figured maybe it would stop by itself. It didn't. And then I decided it was time to sit down with Bill and have a talk with him about why a 5-year-old was too old to wet the bed. Well, that didn't work. The sheets were still wet. I was getting frustrated. I raised my voice. That didn't work. The sheets were still wet. I think I even spanked him one time. And then I knew I was really getting out of control. So I was so frustrated, and there was everything I tried was not solving this problem. It was around that time that my mother gave me a copy of a book called Summerhill by A.S. Neill. A.S. Neill was a schoolmaster in England who had a non-traditional school. He had a really strange way of dealing with his children, the children who misbehaved in his classes. Instead of making them stand in a corner or write 100 times, "I will not misbehave," he gave them a penny when they did something wrong. And I thought, he did what? He gave them a penny? That's not what anybody has taught me. But I tried everything else. Oh, and the interesting thing was, there was nothing moralistic about the way he wrote. It was just, this is what the child was doing. I gave him a penny. And the results almost always were that the child began behaving again. I thought, well, that's interesting. I don't understand this, but I'm also really frustrated. I've tried everything else, so we'll try this with the bedwetting. The next morning, Bill got up. I didn't know what I was doing. I was just following a role model. I went to my wallet. I pulled out a penny. I gave it to him, and I walked away. And as I walked away, he was kind of looking at me in a strange, with a strange look, as this is not normal mother's behavior. What is going on here? But he never went to bed again. And I was blown away, and I couldn't stop thinking about this. So I started playing with this in other situations in my life, where the words came in, and it was a shift in the meaning of words that I'd been taught as a child. One day I went to my front door, and a man was there. He was a neighbor, I think, not a close neighbor, but he lived in the neighborhood, and he was really angry. He was angry with me. I don't remember who he was, what he wore. I don't remember anything about him except the anger. And in the past, I might have gotten defensive and said, oh, you shouldn't be angry over a little thing like that. Or I might have explained why I had done what I did. I didn't do any of that. I simply said, I am sorry. What can I do to make things right? And just like that, the anger stopped. And when he left, we were friends. Now, why do thoughts pop into your head from the strangest places when you least expect them? I don't have the answer to that question, but that's what happened to me as the man left. Nothing had changed. My living room was still there. My kids were still there playing in the living room. But the words that popped into my mind were, resist not evil, but turn the other cheek. These were words I'd been taught years ago in Sunday school. And I thought, oh my gosh, all of a sudden, in the context of this experience, I understood the meaning of those words. As a child, they had made absolutely no sense to me, about as much sense as giving a kid a penny for bad behavior. Because I always thought they meant, well, Janet, just deny your own needs, deny yourself. If somebody hits you on one side of the face, turn the other one to him and say, hit me again. That made no sense. But this was not the instruction behind those words, the meaning behind those words was not to desecrate myself or my own needs. It was a suggestion for conduct that I could do all by myself without any cooperation from anyone else that would shift a whole situation into a win-win situation. And I was blown away. The man was happy because I had listened to him and respected him. And I was happy because an enemy had become a friend. So those are there are two. There are many, many other stories I have along these lines, but those are two stories that show that just by changing myself unilaterally, I could shift a whole situation. And the second story is about the fact that the meaning of words that I thought I understood didn't mean what I thought they meant before.
Well, I think that you're bringing a few different important aspects here. And one of them is the relationship between conduct and the words. So, you know, it came from at least a very personal experience. Yet in that example, it impacted another person. And you said that, well, he felt like he was understood. How did the choice of words, you feel, actually impact that situation? Was it simply, you know, the actual word? Was it how you were sharing them? Was it, you know, how did that play out so that it could actually impact the behavior?
I think it was both. It was both the fact that I said to the man, I am so sorry. What can I do to make this right? But it was also the fact that I really meant those words when I said them. And maybe from my own perspective, it was because I was playing with a new idea and I just figured I'd try something different. But there was an authenticity and a genuineness to the words as I spoke them as well. So it was not only the choice of words, but it was also the underlying energy of the words.
Of course, because, you know, we can say a certain sentence and not be genuine, and then that gets picked up, and I feel that actually can make it more frustrating and increase the anger, because you realize that they're simply telling something perhaps to get rid of you or to be in agreement when they're not. Now, the other aspect that you mentioned was the importance of the meaning of the word. So by that, do you mean the signification of each word that we're using?
Not of each word, but of the entire phrase. The fact that as a child, I had understood those words to mean something different. And they made no sense to me. But in the context of this situation where I could see it as win-win words that I could implement all by myself, all of a sudden it made sense. Everything fit together. And it was absolutely the right thing to do. If what I wanted, and this gets to intention, is a friendship with this man, or at least an ability to treat one another with respect, rather than becoming enemies. And I would always rather have a friendly relationship with people than an unfriendly one.
Right. But when we explore meaning, especially now, I find that we're much more confronted with different cultures as well as different references for what actually words, sentences, expression means. So how do we reconcile it? Because I feel in communication, right, there's the meaning and the intention that I'm projecting, and then I select a series of words. But then there's also a decoding aspect that happens from the other person's, from the other person. And I feel there is a high potential for miscommunication, because we may not necessarily be working from the same library of language. Have you come across that in the work that you've been doing and in your personal experiences?
All the time. And I think there's a big difference between the speaker's intention, which can be perfectly pure, and the effect the words have on the listener, because the listener's conditioning is different, as you mentioned. Either they grew up in a different culture, they were reared differently in a different religion, or with different teachers, or different kinds of parents, or they had different experiences. So each one of us brings our own mix of learnings and experiences to our understanding of words. And I don't think there are any fixed definition meanings of words that we can sort of agree on the meanings of certain words. But even getting beyond that, I think it's really important to become aware of what words do for us. Words structure our experiences. And I think what most of us don't realize is that we all do it differently. And that is why there is the miscommunication. If we can simply stay open, hopefully, to accepting or believing that the other person's intentions are good, even though they may not be expressing themselves really clearly, it's helpful if we can not react to the words that are spoken to us, but try to hear the information in them. What are the needs of this particular person? Sometimes, you know, what are their fears? Are their focuses different from mine? Their intentions? Let me see if I can think of an example here to make this a little clearer. One person might be very focused on the success of a particular university, let's say. And so all his actions and words and intentions are focused on building that university up, making it coherent and internally consistent. But if someone else comes into that environment and their focus is, for example, on really clear communication, an exchange of information. The intentions are different, the focuses are different, and the speech is not going to connect. So there is going to be miscommunication there. If you think of an optical illusion, the one that most people know is the old hag and the young woman. Nothing on that paper changes. Nothing in our outside world changes. What changes is the way our minds chop those fixed experiences up into parts and label them with words. If you go back to the optical illusion, you're either going to see the old hag or you're going to see the young woman. But the words you stick on that fixed image out there are going to be very different. And you may even feel different emotions depending on whether you see the young woman or the old hag. So it's really interesting just to watch what our minds do with these experiences. And I don't know whether your audience is familiar with terms like the Tibetan Buddhist term emptiness or Ken Wilber's term non-dual consciousness. But if you can actually simply be in an experience without sticking any words onto it at all, you are in a state of consciousness called emptiness. So again, it's a label. It's a pointer, it's a finger pointing at the moon, or non-dual consciousness. You are not chopping your experience up into parts and labeling it with words. So I think just to be aware of what we do with our words, we can be more gentle, both with ourselves and with other people as well when we're trying to communicate. And of course, you get into this whole issue, well, we have this whole self-talk thing going on within each one of us. Gee, are his words true or are her words true? What do I believe? And sometimes we're really conflicted and our minds just keep going around in circles while we're trying to sort out, well, who's right and who's wrong? Which words are right and which words are wrong? None of them are either right or wrong. However, they can have meaning for us, and they can be effective in different situations depending on our intentions and what we want to accomplish.
Of course, and you mentioned here becoming aware of what we do with our words, and here I'm seeing internally and externally because of that inner narrator. So, you know, people that might be listening, how do they take a step into really increasing that awareness of what they are doing with their words so that it may be beneficial for themselves and ultimately everyone that's involved in those communications?
One technique that I find really helpful is to just sit down and write. And you write whatever comes into your head. It's very important not to censor yourself. When you're done, if you want, if you go back and look at it, and you don't like what you see or what you've written, you can rip it up, you can burn it, you don't have to show it to anyone else. But it's really important to, it's almost like allowing your subconscious mind to come through. And the stuff that comes out when you do that kind of uncensored journaling is often amazing. I'll begin lots of times with a problem that I'm struggling with, and I'll start writing about it, and I'll start calling other people names and, you know, using a lot of negative words. And then after a while, after I get that out of my system, the language shifts a little bit, maybe into a more positive flow, or maybe toward, again asking, well, how can we resolve this situation? Or how's the other person seeing this? It kind of takes a very zigzaggy path lots of times if I don't try to structure it or censor it. Just let it go down on the page the way it wants to come out. And it almost always comes out at the end in a way that I did not expect, that has a step forward or a solution. It's amazing to watch, because it's as if I am not really in control of what's going on here. If I can get my left brain out of the way, the controlling brain, and just let the words flow onto the page. Another interesting process, I think, is if you're struggling with something, right before you go to bed, just set a question in your mind, whatever it is. How do I bring harmony into this really acrimonious relationship, for example? And you go to sleep with that question foremost in your mind. Lots of times what happens for me, I'll go sound asleep, and then I'll wake up a few hours later and I'm kind of half awake and half asleep. I think that beta brain has kind of settled down into an alpha state or a delta state. And again, it's almost as if my subconscious mind is coming up to the surface and offering answers or solutions that my left brain never could have thought of. And most of the time, they're much better solutions than anything the left brain could have figured out. Does that answer your question?
Yes, that does answer it. And I feel, especially by using the technique of planting the word before going to sleep, I've personally done that. And, well, I do always keep a dream journal next to my bed, just in case I have a really powerful dream that I want to remember. But I feel that might be a good thing to hold as well, because I find otherwise, well, we go about our day and then an hour later, it's like, oh, wait, what was that deep insight that I got during the middle of the night? And it can be fleeting sometimes. And then the rational mind tries to repiece it, and then that's just getting further and further away. You know, it's like, oh no, now you're trying to rationalize how you're going to remember this. So I think just being able to have something to capture, if you do have that insight, is a really good idea.
Now, some people use a recorder too, Paul. They just keep a recorder right by their bed and they mumble into it whatever is in their head, you know, in that half awake, half asleep state. Then you can go back. I mean, the left brain is not useless, that's for sure. In the morning, you can go back and listen again to the recording. And then if you want, you can edit it, try to make sense out of it, pull it together. But then you've got both the right brain representation, and then you can take your left brain and do with it whatever you want.
Of course. And also, if we have these insights, well, it may not necessarily come in a very well-structured plan A, B, C, D in this time frame, right? So we may need to do a little bit of polishing on it. So I had another question for you, and I was curious to know how the use of the language and your perception of it has evolved for you throughout your life, since it's obviously been the focus of a lot of your work.
That's an interesting question. Let's just take a single word, knowledge. After I had this experience with the man at the door, I was really sure I knew, I understood. I had to go tell other people what I understood and what I knew. And my experience with that was that there were these blank eyes and or blank faces and uncomprehending eyes staring back at me. So obviously, nobody was hearing any of the words that I was saying. That caused me to pull back and just look at my own words and, you know, how can I speak more clearly? How can I get this amazing experience across to other people so that they can experience it too? So I began shifting from statements into questions. Or images. At one point, I was so frustrated with words, I started writing poetry. And a lot of it came out as very paradoxical, so that I was including opposites within the same phrase or the same sentence. But what I realized after a while was that the words that appear to be opposite aren't really opposites. Even knowledge and ignorance are not opposites. They simply refer to different experiences or different types of experiences. There's a sense right now in which I can say I know, but there's also a sense in which I function from a beginner's mind. I don't know. I certainly don't know where the person I'm speaking with is coming from. So lots of times I will tell stories or I'll ask questions rather than making statements. Statements lots of times are controversial. If I'm asking questions, lots of times I'm just seeking to get more information about the person I'm speaking with so that I can understand them better. If I start telling them what they should or shouldn't do, I'm getting myself into a lot of trouble. I promise you that.
Right. And now I'm imagining a conversation in which all parties are asking questions. and no one's answering other than by a question. Somehow I'm thinking this would make a great movie. You know, you have these movies where it tends to be very creative and mind expanding. And it's like everyone simply talks true questions.
Well, yeah, and you could certainly do that. Another really good technique for sharing information without a lot of acrimony is circle groups. Your audience is probably familiar with circle groups. The one I've worked with most has been Ron and Victoria Friedman's Vistar circles. But when and there is a structure to it which needs to be respected for it to be able to work. Things like one person speaks at a time, and you try to keep the energy in the circle fairly balanced and the contributions fairly balanced. And it's interesting because in Vistar circles, you don't ask questions. That's one of the requirements. And in that particular context, and context is so important to all these conversations, in that particular context, you don't ask questions because it splits the energy usually between two people, between the questioner and the answerer, and it excludes everybody else in the circle. So it's really very interesting. You need to be aware of the environment you're in. You need to be aware of the people you're speaking with, the conceptual structures that are set up for the conversations. There's some that work really well. With the Vistar circles, when it's done well, nobody wants to leave at the end because it's almost as if the whole group has bonded at a almost a metaphysical level. And people are feeling very aligned and very close. It's wonderful.
And what do you feel causes that bonding experience that may not necessarily be happening in other traditional settings?
I think there are a couple of things that everyone needs, but we don't state these as needs lots of times. Maybe we're not even aware that they're needs. But everyone needs to be heard or feel that they're being listened to. So another skill that we can all develop is just deep listening to the other person. I think people need to feel respected rather than criticized and judged. I think all of us have those needs. So intentional conscious communication to me is trying to respect the other person's speech, respect the other person as a human being, as another human being with needs that perhaps aren't being very well articulated, but the needs are still there. If you study nonviolent communication at all, this is another avenue for clear speaking and deep listening to one another. And sometimes, lots of times you get into asking the person about their feelings. Are you feeling disrespected when I say that? Certainly not that I intend to disrespect you, but maybe that's the way my words are landing on the other person. And if I don't stop to get information about how my words are landing, there's not going to be clear communication between us. The bonding happens when there is deep listening, honest, authentic, clear speaking, no judgment, no criticism, and the speaking is as clear as possible and as specific as possible, so that it has a context that makes it clearer.
Yes, I agree with the importance of the specificity. And I find that's been one of my experiences as I've been listening to myself more and more. And I mean, I have a fast pace when I speak, so that's one of the obstacles of it. But I feel also that gives that energy behind it. So it's not necessarily something I want to let go. But I've been finding that whenever I read or I listen to people and it's very broad, and it can become very confusing about, well, what is actually the message that is being conveyed? And then that inevitably gives me more room for my own personal interpretation, which then gets additionally filtered through my own experiences. Now, one area where I find this particularly challenging is in the written format. Like when we have words either online or on print, then we lose a lot of the tone, the expression, the body language. So how do these concepts translate into a written format?
Not easily. I can guarantee that. When I wrote my book, I struggled because I didn't want to put generalizations out there, first of all, because this is not generalized information. It is, from my perspective, it is about clear, direct communication, probably one-on-one with one other person. I can speak the same words with the same tone to two different people, and each one of them is going to hear something different in my words. So I'm very aware of that. Just being aware of these things, I think, really helps for us to be more tolerant both of ourselves and of others, and probably have more compassion for both ourselves and others as we work through this morass of trying to communicate. Written word is not easy. I say right at the beginning of my book, don't believe a word I write. My words are not truth. My words are vehicles for helping you discover your own truth. And that's, I hope people see that as they read through my book. Because while I have occasionally made statements in there, I've tried to stay away from statements. I've used a lot of poetry, I've used quotes, I've used optical illusions, I've used questions. So it's, and since what we're involved here, in here, really, is opening people's minds up rather than shutting them down, words can, depends on how they're used, but they can shut people's minds down. Words always separate and divide. Experience doesn't separate and divide. It simply is what it is. But as soon as we take that experience and we chop it up into right, wrong, good, bad, high, low, knowledge, ignorance, all these words that appear to be opposites, we think that there's an opposition out there. There doesn't need to be that opposition. We can just be in the experience. And then if the experience is somehow jolting or painful, then we can think about how to use words to shift that so that it becomes more harmonious, if that's our intention, if that's what we want. Have to get really clear on that intention first. What do I want out of this conversation? What do I want out of this relationship?
I find this interesting that you mentioned when you were writing your book, right? You say, well, don't take my words as truth. And then you try to minimize making clear statements. Although on the other hand, I presume you're clearly trying to convey a message. So how did you find that balance in not necessarily turning to, well, hey, I'm not really seeing anything anymore because, you know, we're at the risk of that being misinterpreted. Or perhaps even for people that might be writing right now, like they could almost go in a state where it can sound apologetic, or perhaps, you know, they're not necessarily claiming or taking ownership of an understanding of an authority. And then that, I feel, can devalue the message where, well, where's the credibility if the person can't take position? Is that something that you had to, you know, play with as you were taking on this project?
Well, I definitely had to play with it, and I had to think about it a lot. And what's coming to mind right now is the Tao that can be spoken is not the Tao. And anyone who ultimately has experienced this state of, let's call it, non-dual consciousness, you're in this tension of knowing that none of your words are going to be absolutely correct, and yet the passion and the compulsion to use words, to share it as well as you can figure out to do that with other people without binding them or tying them into knots or getting turned into some kind of guru. So you're a guru and you're not a guru. I don't know how to say that any better. There is a deep knowing and a deep passion there. And I think a lifetime effort to use words maybe to facilitate a shift in another person more than communicate this, let's call it a state of non-dual consciousness, which you really can't. You cannot talk about it accurately. You can use words to point toward it, and there are all kinds of practices out there, meditation and prayer and ritual practices and all kinds of practices that you can use, which are useful and helpful. But the practice is not the ultimate experience. It's a pointer. It's a tool. And that's all my words are. They're pointers or tools.
Yeah, that's a really good way to put it, because I find too, as long as we can stay honest with ourselves, right, and not say, well, this is the truth, and you should be siding along with my opinion, and then we become forceful. But if we're able to be humble about it, then I certainly feel that creates more space. And even in verbal communication, having that humility, which is something, you know, that my wife will say, you know, I need to work hard on the being humble and humility. And even when I made this statement of of wanting to be more humble, I made it in a non-humble way, as if, oh, okay, because that's like the next level of my evolution, you know?
You know, I don't even like that term level of evolution. For me, a way of thinking about this that is more helpful is if you think of a sphere, and each one of us is at some point in that sphere because of all our conditioning and our lifetime experiences and the way we've been taught to think and the way we've thought on our own. And we're all trying to get to that center point. But since we're all starting from a different place and our paths are very different, so you really can't tell another person how to get there. Sometimes I think all you can really do is listen to them, respect them, create an I-thou relationship rather than an I-you relationship or I-them relationship, which is very separative. But it's a real intention to connect at a very deep level. And that leaves aside a whole discussion about ethics and morals and right conduct, which I think I'm not going to try to get into here. That's another whole focus of this. But none of this is easy, but it's so fascinating. And it is totally creative and co-creative. It's always changing, always shifting.
Of course, and even that's why when I was reflecting on it, it's like, it was almost, well, being more humble seems to be like the next stage that I need to get to. But as I was, you know, considering it, I'm realizing, well, that's clearly not one how it's going to be happening. And secondly, is the approach itself didn't feel right. It's kind of like more, well, again, let's say I speak faster and I'm like, well, you know what? The next stage now is for me to have a very calm demeanor. Well, now it feels like it may get there, but if I'm just stating it and making it a performance of some sort, then I'm fighting against myself. And I truly don't believe that this is what will help me or other people around reach a state of deeper harmony. Now, there is another piece that I wanted to go a little bit more into, which is, and I find that's been tied to what we talked about with the book, which is the editing process. And I'd be curious to know if you were the one that edited your book yourself, and regardless of who edited it, how did that experience connect with influencing the meaning and the impact of the communication?
No, I'm sure I did have it edited because I created that book with a great deal of care. And I really choreographed anything that I put into writing, and I choreograph it with a great deal of care so that everything fits together as well as possible. I don't remember who did that for me. No, I did. I had a developmental editor who helped me take material that is not linear and put it into some kind of linear form. And then I had a copy editor who sort of look for better ways to say things. I had someone who just looked for mistakes of grammar, and I had someone who did indexing for me, who clearly didn't have a very deep understanding of consciousness because his indexing could have been substantially improved. But yes, I wanted other eyes to look at what I had written, and if they came up with something that was better than what I had thought of, I definitely changed it. So it was kind of a co-creative process in many ways. A very interesting, time-consuming, and not easy.
What's coming to my mind here is a play where that work and that collaboration happens. And then as the characters, how do we actually interpret it? And then there is that molding work that happens to really tell a story. Do you feel like that connects in any way to the process that you were undergoing with that book?
The process I was undergoing with the book. Now, I'm not sure I quite understand your question, so maybe you could ask me in a different way.
Of course. So when you were explaining how you had the developmental editor helping making it more linear, and then you had someone else helping perhaps with the grammar, and then you had someone with the indexing, but there's all these different people that were helping essentially with the clarity of the communication that we were having in the book. And when I'm considering a play, I see that, you know, there's the actual play itself that is written, but then there is the director, and then there is the artist, and there's an exchange about, well, how to best convey the essence of the characters, how to best convey the story also behind of it in all these intricacies. But there's a sort of like sculpting process that happens from the start of, you know, the idea of the play, and then once it actually gets delivered and performed for an audience. And I was sensing that in creating the book, there was that initial idea, and then there was a process undertaken to really refine all of these elements. And there was a certain collaboration, at least with these editors, involved. Now, as I'm explaining it, I'm like, well, am I just explaining it, or am I leading to a question? That's become interesting to myself. But maybe it's like I had the feeling that it was almost like a sculpture that was being shaped. And maybe you can just comment generally on that, or that was enough for the general purposes. I'm getting lost myself, and hopefully for the people listening, this is making like total sense.
No, it's making perfect sense to me. Yes, it was a sculpture, and it was a living sculpture that kept morphing and growing and shifting as different people brought in their particular skills or energies to the shape of the whole. And I know in the very beginning of the acknowledgement section, I thought, to whom do I owe acknowledgements for this book, for whatever it's worth? And I thought, everybody in my life with whom I have ever had contact has ultimately influenced both me and this book in some way. And then, of course, I picked out specific people who had particularly influenced my thinking. But everyone that I've had contact with, whether they've been pleasant contacts or unpleasant contacts, all of those have contributed both to my own growth and development and to what went into the book. And yes, there's a sense in which it is like a play, and the different characters come in with their different types of speech. I deliberately wanted to include quotes and poems and written sections and images, because they were all different ways that I could use to communicate the same underlying essence, which really cannot be directly communicated other than perhaps with a very warm hug or a very deep listening to someone who is stressed. I don't know how else to say that.
Yes.
But it is a dance, you see, Paul. It is a dance with words and wisdom. And it doesn't end until our bodies die. I'm not sure it even ends then.
Yes, and actually that's making the connection with dancing with wisdom, because, you know, obviously a lot of our conversation has been focusing on words and communication, and then you talked about knowledge a little bit earlier, but, you know, what does that represent, dancing with wisdom, for you?
I can give an example of that, and that's around the topic of fear. I used to live in terror of lots of things. I certainly lived in terror of saying no to people, setting boundaries or limits. I lived in terror of what I believed I knew and putting it out into the world, because people who put this kind of information out into the world frequently get assassinated. I mean, you look at Dr. Martin Luther King, you look at Gandhi, you look at Jesus, you look at Socrates. I think one of the only major teachers who didn't get killed was the Buddha. So people who are trying to deal with these very, I don't even know what word to use here. I mean, you can use the word metaphysical, but I don't know. People tend to think of that as being separate from our everyday world, and it's not really separate. When you're trying to deal with something that is ultimately unified and integrated, words which separate and divide just don't do it. To get there, I mean, there's some questions, I think, that are really helpful for each person to ask themselves in any situation. It's, what do I think? What do I feel? What do I need? What are my choices? And getting back to this whole issue of fear, what I learned about fear was that when I was feeling afraid, my mind was focused either into the future, what if this happens, what if that happens, or it was focused on what somebody else might think, say, or do if I did what my heart was telling me to do. Once I realized that, then I had a choice. I could either keep my mind focused into the future or onto what somebody else might think, say, or do. or I could bring my mind back to the present moment, just consciously, conscious choice. Okay, bring your mind back to the present moment. It's usually really safe where I was right here, right now. And then ask myself, what's my next step? What can I do right here, right now, to make a difference or to move my life in the direction that I want to move it? And when I did that, I was taking my power back. I wasn't giving it away to the future or giving it away to other people. I was taking it back into the present moment, right here, right now. And then just dealing with one single next step, which was really easy. And it could be whatever I felt I could handle, in whatever way I felt I could handle.
I feel there's a lot of self-honoring in that process, right? In whatever way that you could handle. And that's been a big part and is still a big part of my learning experiences. Like, how big of a bite can I and do I want to chew?
That's the question. I mean, and it absolutely is self-honoring and self-transparency and self-acceptance. Authenticity is one of my very favorite words. Even if I don't speak my, if I choose not to speak my truth to other people, I need to be really clear within myself what my truth is. And then I can decide how to work with that truth and how to bring more of that truth out into the world, knowing that other people may be threatened by it, may be frightened by it, may react to it, and being able to hold those responses in silence or compassion or an attempt to understand as well as I'm able. There are times when I have to move out of a relationship because it drains my energy too much. That's a self-honoring too, is the setting boundaries and saying, no, I can't stay in this relationship unless you're willing to stop doing whatever. So, focusing on one's own truth, I think, is really important. And another thing that's has been really important for me, and let me just give a little background here. I was reared Unitarian, and as a child and a young adult, I was pretty much an agnostic. When the word God came up, all I could think of was that picture of the old man with a long white beard sitting up on a cloud with a thunderbolt in his hand waiting to strike me dead if I didn't do some unclear thing he wanted me to do. And I was really clear I didn't believe in that, but I didn't have anything to substitute for that. I went through a really terrifying experience with fear. Talk about dark nights of the soul. That was one for me, where I was between a rock and a hard place, and I did not know which way to turn. But I knew I would have to make a decision one way or another. And the choice was between staying in my own authenticity and saying no to somebody else or caving in to what somebody else wanted me to do. I was so desperate that I sank to my living room floor on my knees, tears streaming down my face. And I was just crying out, God, help me. I don't know what to do here. And it was, again, one of these amazing experiences. As I spoke those words, this huge calm came over me. And it felt as if somehow now I had support. And together, somehow, we would deal with this. And I didn't know how. But that connection is vital to my ability to stay in my own authenticity. And it, for me, it's kind of like turning the dial of a radio. You turn it and you get a whole pile of human static with everybody talking and everybody saying something different. And then you turn a little farther and you get to a point on that radio dial where the reception is crystal clear. And when you hit that point, you know that's what you need to do or the next step that you need to take. And that connection for me is absolutely vital.
Thank you for sharing that. I know that this is something that a lot of people can relate to one degree or another. And I can certainly relate to those experiences where, you know, it's just asking. For me, I say asking the universe. It's like, help me. Like, please help me. And it's in that moment where, again, it just feels like I don't know what to do anymore. And the pressure almost becomes too much, you know, and then it's like giving oneself into something bigger, but still knowing that you have a part to play in it. You know, it's not a total abandonment. At least that's not how it happened for me. And, you know, especially if someone is listening right now and you are facing perhaps a challenging situation, well, you have the right to ask. You know, you have to, this is something that is possible for you as well. So I really thank you for bringing this up, Janet.
You're welcome. It was a huge turning point in my life. But it almost seems as if I've had to go down through these dark nights of the soul and surrender. It was a surrendering for me in order to receive something that my mind cannot understand. I mean, Christians use the word grace for something, for an experience like that. And you were using the word, I think, like try to be more humble earlier. This is something you don't try to receive. You have to allow yourself to be open to receive from other people, from nature, from whatever word you want to use for a higher power or a power greater than ourselves. And you can't objectify any of this stuff. This is it's more, and words, the words don't work here, but I'm going to use them anyway. It's more an energetic connection, or you can call it intuition, or sometimes it's a letting go or surrendering, or opening yourself up to what is.
Right, and that's why when I had been working on that, I immediately recognized that this was not going to be the way that it would happen. Another way that I look at it too is like taking a position or a stance or something like that. I feel like the concept of positioning for me personally resonates a lot. And then it's, well, you know, finding a place or that openness which you were discussing, which you were mentioning. This has been truly an enjoyable time, and I've certainly learned a lot through this exchange, and I appreciate you deeply. I also want to make sure that our audience knows where they can contact you, perhaps find more information about your work, your book, and if they want to engage perhaps in an exchange with you, where would they be able to find you?
Well, my email address is Janet, J-A-N-E-T, at Word, W-O-R-D, Sculptures, S-C-U-L-P-T-U-R-E-S.com. I have several websites. I have WordSculptures.com. I have JanetSmithWarfield.com. Which is a blog on many of these very challenging topics. I have a membership website, consciousnessshift.com. This summer, I will be one of the presenters for the Association of Global New Thought in a series that they are putting on. So, and I'm on Facebook, LinkedIn, all the social media sites. So there are lots of ways to get in touch with me. And of course, yeah, my book, My book is on, the easiest way to get it is on Amazon, and it is in hardcover, paperback, audiobook, which is interesting. It's a totally different experience from reading the book. Again, the context makes a difference, and I had new players in there, and also it's on Kindle. And I'm in the process of writing another book, probably a couple of books, and I'm working right now with a very good editor on those, taking a lot of things I've already written and helping me shape them into more books.
That's exciting. And I want to make sure we have the book right. Was that Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World?
That's the name of the book.
Okay, perfect. So then that can be found on Amazon. What I'll be doing is include all of the websites and the email that you mentioned on the show notes. So if you're listening right now and perhaps you may not be able to take notes, you'll be able to find that over there. And Janet, is there a closing word that you would like to offer our audience?
I guess the best thing I can say to anyone is love yourself, trust yourself, be compassionate with yourself, and stay open to all the support that is available to you if you just open your eyes and you become willing to receive. Ask yourself questions like, what do I think? What do I think, not what does somebody else think, what do I think about this situation? What do I feel? That's really important to get in touch with your emotions. Even if your emotion is fear or rage, those emotions have really important messages. What do I think? What do I feel? What do I need? That's so important. What do I need? Once you get clear on what you need, you may be able to get that need met in a very simple way. And sometimes it will come in a way that you don't even expect. It's just there if you stay open to noticing and receiving. And then what are my choices? You're always in choice in every single situation. I don't care what it is. I mean, the simple choice is, yes, I'm going to do this, or no, I'm not going to do this. And get clear about why. What are the values behind those choices? What really matters? What really matters in your life? And then go for it.
That's a very empowering message. And for me, I particularly like what you said about choices. I agree with you with that one. And, you know, whether the choice is not to do anything, it's still a choice. So, again, it was a real pleasure to have you with us. And for you, the listener, I appreciate you taking this time for yourself and for everyone else, because I believe that by, you know, really nurturing your own process, you are actually making an impact in your families, and with your friends, within your communities, and in your own life. So we are actually together, you know, taking this shift and creating the world that we all want to see come true. If you did enjoy this episode of The Spiritual Voice, I invite you to share this with at least one friend that you believe will benefit from it. And if you haven't done so already, you can leave us a review on iTunes, and this will help support getting visibility for the show and reaching a broader audience. The last invitation is for you to visit our website, thespiritualvoice.com, and there you're going to have access to some of our free resources, as well as programs and spiritual pilgrimages that focus on cultivating presence and spiritual health. Thanks again, Janet, and it was truly a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it's been delightful for me too, Paul. Thank you for having me on.
Today's episode was brought to you by the Spiritual Voice Community, where heart-centered seekers connect to build meaningful relationships, expand their spiritual practice together, and celebrate the discovery of everyday life. head over to thespiritualvoice.com for full recaps of every show and to access our resources and programs that help you develop spiritual health and greater presence.
On Facebook, LinkedIn, all the social media sites. So there are lots of ways to get in touch with me. And of course, my book is on, the easiest way to get it is on Amazon, and it is in hardcover, paperback, audiobook, which is interesting. It's a totally different experience from reading the book. Again, the context makes a different difference. And I had new players in there. And also it's on Kindle. And I'm in the process of writing another book, probably a couple of books. And I'm working right now with a very good editor on those, taking a lot of things I've already written and helping me shape them into more books.
That's exciting. And I want to make sure we have the book right. Was that Shift, Change Your Words, Change Your World?
That's the name of the book.
Okay, perfect. So then that can be found on Amazon. What I'll be doing is include all of the websites and the email that you mentioned on the show notes. So if you're listening right now and perhaps you may not be able to take notes, you'll be able to find that over there. And Janet, is there a closing word that you would like to offer our audience?
I guess the best thing I can say to anyone is love yourself, trust yourself, be compassionate with yourself, and stay open to all the support that is available to you if you just open your eyes and you become willing to receive. Ask yourself questions like, what do I think? What do I think? Not what does somebody else think? What do I think about this situation? What do I feel? That's really important to get in touch with your emotions. Even if your emotion is fear or rage, those emotions have really important messages. What do I think? What do I feel? What do I need? That's so important. What do I need? Once you get clear on what you need, you may be able to get that need met in a very simple way. And sometimes it will come in a way that you don't even expect. It's just there if you stay open to noticing and receiving. And then what are my choices? You're always in choice in every single situation. I don't care what it is. I mean, the simple choice is, yes, I'm going to do this, or no, I'm not going to do this. And get clear about why. What are the values behind those choices? What really matters? What really matters in your life? And then go for it.
That's a very empowering message. And for me, I particularly like what you said about choices. I agree with you with that one. And, you know, whether the choice is not to do anything, it's still a choice. So again, it was a real pleasure to have you with us. And for you, the listener, I appreciate you taking this time for yourself and for everyone else, because I believe that by, you know, really nurturing your own process, you are actually making an impact in your families, with your friends, within your communities, and in your own life. So we are actually together, you know, taking this shift and creating the world that we all want to see come true. If you did enjoy this episode of The Spiritual Voice, I invite you to share this with at least one friend that you believe will benefit from it. And if you haven't done so already, you can leave us a review on iTunes, and this will help support getting visibility for the show and reaching a broader audience. The last invitation is for you to visit our website, thespiritualvoice.com, and there you're going to have access to some of our free resources, as well as programs and spiritual pilgrimages that focus on cultivating presence and spiritual health. Thanks again, Janet, and it was truly a wonderful conversation.
Yeah, it's been delightful for me too, Paul. Thank you for having me on.
Today's episode was brought to you by the Spiritual Voice Community, where heart-centered seekers connect to build meaningful relationships, expand their spiritual practice together, and celebrate the discovery of everyday life. Head over to thespiritualvoice.com for full recaps of every show and to access our resources and programs that help you develop spiritual health and greater presence.
Well, thank you for having me on.
Today's episode was brought to you by the Spiritual Voice Community, where heart-centered seekers connect to build meaningful relationships, expand their spiritual practice together, and celebrate the discovery of everyday life. Head over to thespiritualvoice.com for full recaps of every show and to access our resources and programs that help you develop spiritual health and greater presence.